So my goal is to tie these three presentations together and to examine the implications for the practice of health education. And what you see are the logos of America's health educators. And the question we have to ask ourselves, is that who we're going to leave the responsibility for health education with, or are we going to take it back? And I hope to review some of the evidence on these three questions. We've heard a lot of it in these three presentations. And then to look at what our role is, what we can do to challenge the domination of providing health information that these three industries provide. So I think we all know that chronic diseases, also known as non-communicable diseases or NCDs, are now the primary cause of both premature death and preventable illnesses in the world today. NCDs pose a really daunting public health challenge, not only to the United States, but to the world as a whole. And if in this country and around the world, we're going to be able to achieve the health goals that we've articulated in official documents by governments and health professional organizations, then we're going to need to do a better job in preventing non-communicable diseases. And a report a few years ago prepared for the United Nations high-level meeting on non-communicable diseases held in New York in September 2011 identified the leading drivers of non-communicable diseases, and that was tobacco use, alcohol use, foods high in fat, sugar, and salt, and physical inactivity. And these images show you some of the illustrations of that. And these are data showing the increases in the decade from 2000 to 2010 in the use of various unhealthy products. And note that these are not use, but increase in use in that decade. And note particularly the increases in Asia and the Middle East and Africa in what's called here ready meals, which is essentially fast food. And this shows you this trends, the predicted trends in this current period. And again, only in North America and Western Europe are the increases modest, or do we see some slight declines? The global spread of tobacco, alcohol, and food will be the primary drivers of global health inequities in the decades to come, to delaying our ambitious goals of health for all that we articulated only a few years ago. So in the United States, we spend about $8 billion a year promoting tobacco, about $4 billion a year promoting alcohol, and these figures from the USDA, about $13 billion promoting food. And of that, about $2 billion are directly promoting food to children. So we spend about $25 billion a year promoting the products most associated with non-communicable diseases. That's about $68 million a day, about $80 per person per year for the U.S. population. And in the U.S., we spend about 2.3 times as much promoting alcohol, food, and tobacco as the entire expenditures for the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. That's crazy, right? A nation that wants to protect the health of its population cannot sustainably improve health with that practices. So we've heard from Michelle and David and Cheryl some of the practices that the three industries we're talking about use. And I think the reason that corporate practices are such a powerful influence on health is not only do they shape our physical and social environments, but they also get inside our head by using these practices. And that's really where we as health educators have to think about what are the antidotes. And the problem, I think, is what I've come to call hyperconsumption, which is really an ideology, a belief system that promotes behaviors, lifestyles, values, and environments that contribute to premature death and preventable illnesses and injuries. And hyperconsumption is not a characteristic of individuals. It's a characteristic of a social and economic and political system. And if we want to understand the ways of reversing these increases in consumption-related non-communicable diseases, we need to identify that system and begin to develop a strategy to change it. And I've come to use the word corporate consumption complex to describe the network of corporations shown in the center, the banks and other financial institutions, hedge funds that fund them, the lawyers, the lobbying firms, the AstroTurf groups they create, the trade associations, all of which you've heard about in the last three presentations. And Dwight Eisenhower, when he left office in 1961, warned America about the military-industrial complex, which he said was a threat to the future of our nation, to peace and to democracy. And in my view, in the coming decades, it's the corporate consumption complex and their promotion of hyperconsumption that is the salient threat to the well-being of our population, but also to environment and to our democracy. And so we need to figure out what's a strategy to take on this complex. And I talk about some of these in more detail in my book, Lethal But Legal, which will be out in February by Oxford University Press. And I propose really three broad strategies that can begin to tie together the work that we're doing in tobacco, alcohol, food, and other products as well, pharmaceuticals and so on. So first, I think we need to have a different ideology than hyperconsumption, one that promotes healthy, sustainable, joyful consumption. It can't be an ideology of prohibition and abstinence, but a different way of thinking about consumption. We need to contest the way that the industries that we've talked about today appropriate science and politics to promote hyperconsumption. And in the long term, we need to think about what's a way of dismantling this complex, which is, I really think, the salient threat to health, democracy, and the environment. So what does all this have to do with health education? So as health educators, I think we have some decisions to make. And there are really two paths in front of us. One is business as usual, which the American Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics illustrates, which is to partner with industry to find ways of working together to occasionally criticize them, but to say that it's too hard to bring about those changes. And the other path, obviously the one I favor, is to say that we as public health professionals, as health educators, are going to reclaim our responsibility, the historic mission of public health, to educate people about health. And to do this, I think, simply requires fulfilling the roles delineated for us in the competencies that schools of public health and professional organizations say we're supposed to do. These are things that we're paid to do, but I think to take on the role that we're contesting hyperconsumption would require a very different way of thinking about what our jobs are. And I look forward to having some time for discussion to talk about these things. And if the panelists can come up, and we really open to hear your responses and your questions and comments. Yes.
Support those efforts, but still. people who, you know, if they can buy the whole grain Triscuits that are still loaded with sugar, it's better than the Cheetos.
That's actually one of the Academy's biggest arguments, right, that we have to meet people where we are and that we need these companies at the table. I mean, not to dismiss how you're phrasing it, and taking the sentiment of what you're saying and letting them in on their spin. But I guess I want to say that from to answer your specific challenge, it doesn't mean that you have to convert, you know, if you're dealing with clients overnight from a junk food diet to, you know, a raw vegan diet. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that, you know, there's a problem here in the conflict of interest that exists with these corporations, you know, really promoting its, you know, maybe slightly less bad for you junk food. Right? So I think that there should be a reality check, though, when we're looking at, for example, you know, some of these product labeled whole grain. I mean, but that's external milk because labeling cookie crisp cereal whole grain, right? And that's not a better recommendation for your client than, you know, the product before was labeled whole grain, right? So, you know, I think we need to distinguish between the health washing that's going on with these products and the companies that are promoting them for their own benefit. Then, of course, the very real challenges that we face with people and trying to get them simply to be healthier.
No, and the only comment that I would make is that I think that most of what we're trying to say has to do with the policy side of the equation, and I think the policy side of the equation is different than the front line part of the equation. But if you're working in the health department, certainly your commissioner of health is in that type of a dialogue through the National Association of County Health Officers. Things like what is available in your community that can be purchased with SNAP. You know, are you trying to deplete the health deserts that do exist in your community? How do you raise awareness? The health commissioner has a bully pulpit within any area. If they call a press conference about something, people will show up. So, I mean, there are a lot of tools that are available without a lot of money to move the needle on the policy side in even a very small community. In fact, sometimes even easier to do in a small community than a large, complex community. I don't know exactly where you're from. But I think it's very important not to conflate the individual who's being victimized by the system with the victimizers. And I think we're basically talking about calling account the victimizers.
So I feel very lucky to live in Baltimore. We have a lot of big public health problems, but at this point in time, we also have an incredible commissioner, city health commissioner. And just drawing on that example, I mean, our health department did neighborhood health profiles for all the neighborhoods of Baltimore, really showed the disparities very clearly. Some of the students in our school got engaged in the planning and zoning rewrite that's happening in the city and run a health impact assessment of it and really pushed an existing political, existing policy process much more in the direction of public health than it would have gone. And for me, on the alcohol side, concrete results of that are in the zoning package. There are things that are going to help our neighborhoods reduce the number of alcohol outlets and reduce the abuse of licenses by alcohol sellers who have turned things that are supposed to be taverns into 24-hour, you know, or close to very long-houred package stores. So three things that health departments do. You've got data, and the data is fabulous, and framing the data so that it can support change, like they did with the neighborhood profiles. You could do a neighborhood profile that would never lead to a change agenda, or you can do one that really highlights obvious things that can change, be changed with policy. And then our health commissioner called the alcohol outlet thing. She's got a 10-point program for Safe and Healthy Baltimore by 2015, and point 10 is right-sizing our alcohol outlets, which I think is a great frame. So data is one, policy two, and the third one is training. And health departments can do that. I like to call that organizing because that's a big piece of what that training activity can be, but again, it's a role that health departments can play.
I'm going to suggest that to give more people a chance to talk, that we maybe hear three or four comments, questions, and then give the panel a chance to respond, and then we'll take another three or four. So let's hear from three or four folks, and then we'll have a response, and then we'll hear another round. So why don't we start with this side and just work our way back, and then we'll have a response. Yes, go ahead.
So I'm looking at a totally different perspective from the previous question. And how about managing the undue influences on those corporations and the local processes that are taking place, like the fallout of the high-level meeting on NCDs and the role of the food and alcohol industries in the implementation of the global action plan on NCDs and the post-technology 2015 development agenda. I'm involved heavily in those processes, and even through PAPO, what I've seen, for example, in that case, is those corporations aim for getting money through PAPO for the implementation of a regional strategy on SDGs, which even backtracks some of the tobacco policies, because the tobacco industry, the food industry, you don't want to see the same type of measures that are implemented on tobacco on their products. So what would you suggest as a good strategy to try to keep them at bay?
Yes.
So I'm aware of the truth campaign, the concept behind it, and the intention was to get you to rebel against the corporate marketers who were manipulating them. And it was very effective. And that should be able to be used also without the law in the food industries and probably just about any industry that targets young people. And so it leads me to wonder, instead of developing multiple different campaigns, one for alcohol, one for food, one for whatever else, that there could be a general campaign just about rebelling against this manipulation of young people.
Right. Yes.
My question is especially to Dr. Fuldenberg, and I'm really excited to read his book. Before that, I'm really interested to know how you are going to engage corporate leaders, especially when profit is a conflict of interest. I'd make a question. Okay.
Thank you. Yes, in the back. People on the panel a minute or two to respond to these set of questions, and maybe we'll start with you, Michelle.
So many, I'm overwhelmed. I want to start with Jason. May I ask you the one that I have to say? I'm not going to respond. I'm going to let you say the others. So I'll pick up on Jason's question about the truth campaign and whether we could do something cross issue. I'm not sure. I've never thought about that, so I don't want to give an off-the-cuff response. But I do want to just give a little bit of reality check on the whole idea of educational campaigns as the answer. I know you're not saying it's the only answer, but, you know, my impression of the truth campaign is it was effective as long as it was funded, right? And, you know, we really are up against those numbers, and it gave us, you know, billions and billions of dollars worth of advertising. And like Ms. Stern is, you know, we have this challenge right now in the food where there's a lot more activity around promoting healthy food. So, like, firstly, you just, you know, came to deal with that Sesame Street, that put almost stickers on the produce, you know, and fresh produce. And now the one part of the supermarket that was devoid of marketing is now going to be flooded with marketing, you know, and I'm not sure that's the best strategy when, as we ignore, you know, all of the bad marketing. So I just want to be cautious about going down that road too much. I mean, where we can have some effectiveness on youth to show them how industry is, you know, exploiting them, et cetera. I'm for that, but I just don't want that to be instead of, you know, doing away with the, all the bad forms of marketing.
So I'm just going to answer yours as well, because I have thought a lot about it, as you can imagine. First of all, the Truth Campaign, a similar version of that in California, that was not directed at tobacco consumers, but instead to change the attitude of the entire state such that policy change would readily pass, was highly effective. And in fact, if one were to choose which would have been the most effective mass media campaign for Legacy to run, as the former CEO, I will tell you, I would have chosen a national denormalization campaign aimed at changing national policy and local policy. The MSA required that the public education campaign be targeted at the primary prevention of smoking among youth, and it was very effective and it was worth doing, don't get me wrong. Kirk is correct to say that we launched with $120 million. Today, in the last year, probably spent $30 million on that campaign because there was a sunset clause in funding in the Master Settlement Agreement. We have put together, with partners, a working paper on how the Truth Campaign concept could be taken to an adolescent primary prevention platform and presented it to a number of AGs. There are many complicated political reasons for why that potentially is problematic, but let me first say that the whole idea of public education, I think it's the difference between education and hard-hitting anti-industry and sustained education. They are entirely different. They have entirely different impacts. Truth was the latter, and it was therefore much more impactful than, if, for example, never was in school. We resisted umpteen efforts to try to get us into school where we felt exactly where we didn't belong because it was a youth-to-youth brand. It was peers talking to peers, and it was allowing them to rebel against adults by rejecting the products they were trying to make profits on by using their body and their health and their life. So really, this whole question comes down to, you know, what are you trying to change? Are you trying to change attitudes, to change policy? Are you trying to change direct behavior? Are you trying to incite hostility toward an industry that deserves hostility and therefore effectiveness, and which is what the Truth Campaign is. So the next step is, how are you going to do it? So from 1968 to 1972 in the U.S. was the first time there was a national mass public education campaign against tobacco. It was extremely effective in reducing both adult and youth smoking, and it was all provided with 3-year time mandated under the Fairness Doctrine. Fairness Doctrine was, which required equal time. It was originally, you know, equal time in a political context, but it was extended to the concept of harmful products. And when that was eliminated, then the ability for there to be equal time was eliminated. Twice, the Congress has voted in a majority to bring back the Fairness Doctrine, which would then mandate equal free airtime. And today, I don't think that they have the say of jurisdiction over the internet, but talk about a free ride. The providers and purveyors of the internet market are getting total free ride. They're providing nothing that would be termed a public service announcement that they're required to do. Or you could argue you could ask them to set aside 5% of time. In some countries, 1% of time is set aside. In the U.S., it's purely voluntary. There is no standard. There was a standard under the Fairness Doctrine. In both of those cases, when it twice passed Congress with a majority, it needed two-thirds to be brought back, so it was never brought back. So to me, that's the how. The how is to find a way to say we as a society are going to find a way to fundamentally push back. And then the what becomes very much determined by what the overall agenda is. And there's no way that this type of mass information can alone solve the problem. But the extent to which it can be a lever should not be underestimated. I came to my job at Legacy really being somewhat skeptical about what one could advertise on social. And I have to tell you that I became decidedly less skeptical afterwards, because essentially what we're doing is we're just handing ourselves over to the corporation to let them drive the conversation and the decisions of consumers, because they're being very successful in doing so. So if they're so successful in doing so, we shouldn't be so skeptical that we could be equally successful in undoing what they're doing.
Okay, I'm going to try to touch on each of the questions briefly. I'm going to start with the most specific, which was the one about small packaging and sachets. I don't see that as a solution primarily around the world. What we see those oriented to is poor populations of kids. They are introductory to the global brands, and in Nigeria, what I'm told is kids are bringing them to school in their lunch boxes, and by about 2 or 3 in the afternoon, the class gets increasingly unmanageable. Now I'm going to go to the highest level of, and so in terms of packaging, it's up to public health to set the standards, and then the industry to figure out how to work within those standards. I don't think we can look to the industry's initiatives to get us out of this. The managing the undue influence, there's two things that we do. We expose, so we do research, we try to get that research out there, et cetera, and we organize. And we're lobbying in Geneva as well as the industry. We are tiny little, we're like gnats on the face of a behemoth, but gnats can bite too. And it's really important that we're there. At all. There's virtually no funding for this, and, you know, that's what we're trying to do. But it's a larger issue, and I want to come back to Truth a little bit, because I think Truth did so much more. Part of what we've done in tobacco is we've delegitimized an entire industry. And this delegitimization is part of counter-advertising, and in my field, in alcohol, we do almost nothing with counter-advertising. There's one group in Dover, New Hampshire that I send everyone to because youth-driven counter-ads are cool. Youth are very hard to shut up, and they can say things that adults can't. And they've done some terrific work for very little money, but basically we're not using that strategy. The good counter-advertising does paint the industry into a new corner, which is, I think, how we're going to engage corporate leaders. I don't think corporate leaders should come running to this like Saul on the road to Damascus. I think if we rebrand them, they're going to have to rebrand themselves. And that's part of what you do with a delegitimization campaign. And so then I want to refer over to Nick, because I think this truly is a hegemonic debate, that we are talking about ideology, we need to be thinking as health educators about those hegemonic, those big ideological issues at the same time that we're dealing with the micro-level behaviors.
Wow. So I'll also try and respond to a few of the questions, and I wanted to start with the global processes question, which I think is a very... the slogan of this meeting is think global and local, and I think we really need to be able to think and act at global, national, and local levels simultaneously, and to have those different levels feed into each other. And when we're able to do that, I think we can see successes, and I think there's a lot to learn from the AIDS movement in their successes in being able to bring together local, national, and global action. In particular, I think for those of us who are concerned about the role of tobacco, alcohol, and food in non-communicable diseases, I think there are two sort of parallel goals. One is to remove corporations from any processes making decisions about public health policy. And I think the quote from Margaret Chan about alcohol, the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control has made that statement about tobacco, that I don't think corporations whose mandate is to make a profit have a role in discussing what public health policy should be. It might be appropriate to talk to them once we've decided on what those policies should be, strategies for implementation, but not what that policy should be. And almost conversely, when we're talking about trade policy, which has such an important role in the spread of alcohol, tobacco, and unhealthy food around the world, and I think it would be a stain on our reputation as public health professionals if we allowed to happen with food and alcohol what has happened with tobacco, which is that our successes in the United States and the developed world pawn those problems off to the developing world, to the global south. We cannot allow that to happen, and that's why we need to act at these different levels. And trade policy is really critically important. And today, for the most part, public health professionals and public health organizations are excluded from those discussions. We're only at the margins. Some of the debates going on now around the Trans-Pacific Partnership illustrate that, around food, around tobacco, and some also around alcohol. And so we need to be looking to bring public health folks, both national governments and NGOs, into those debates. Switching back to the local level, at the City University of New York, my colleagues and I have been working to develop health campaigns for the 270,000 students who are enrolled in CUNY. And one of our starting points is to begin to train a group of young people to be counter-marketers of alcohol, food, and tobacco, and to do those things simultaneously, and to do that not only in our campuses, but also in the other settings where they encounter young people, their peers, their younger brothers and sisters. And I think if we could create hundreds and then thousands and then tens of thousands of young people who had skills and knowledge to bring healthy consumption messages and anti-corporate messages out into the world, that would be a very powerful force. And while I think the truth mode in an earlier era required a mass media, I think now with social media, many of these things can be done at a very different level. And agreeing with some of the previous speakers, we need to look at some of the ways that industry has been using the social media and really flip that on its head and figure out how we can use those to advance health. And I agree with David, the way we engage corporate leaders is by putting pressure on them. The reason that McDonald's is now offering apples and salads is because there's a food movement. And the more we want them to change, the more pressure we need to put on them. I don't think the change comes about by sitting down at the table with them. It comes about putting pressure on them in the media, in the streets, in Congress, in courts, and so on. So let's take another round of questions, and then we'll probably need to wrap up. Yes?
Yeah, hi. I guess this question is especially for Michelle Simon, whether the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics is actually conceivable that the Academy might take a position on advertising food to children. The reason I ask is because the American Academy of Pediatrics does have a position. The committee, the Communications and Media Committee, came out 2 years ago and said explicitly that there should be a ban on advertising to children. Now, the Academy hasn't really done much with that, and those of us within the Academy are trying to push it more in that direction to use some of its muscle to actually put that forward in Congress and in the public. I don't know if that's going to work, so I have no clue about the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, so I'm curious.
Okay. Three or four more questions? Yes.
Sort of thinking aloud, but I've done some research on what it's like to see agave workers as a result of the production of tequila, working with an artisanal tequila manufacturer. So they're being hit by the big beverage corporations because they bought out all the major tequila names. They have no marketing opportunity. The entire quality of tequila has gone way down. So I'm just talking about tequila. You can talk about malt. You can talk about any of them. So I understand the same way, including beer. Any artisanal beer is running into a major problem of obtaining toxins because they get it so small. Can those artisanal manufacturers be used as can we work with
you?
Yes.
Hi. I'm wondering about your public health involvement and overturning Citizens United and supporting campaign funding reform as a way of getting an industry power over policy.
Any other questions? Comments? Great. So maybe, again, we can go in order and take a minute and a half, and then we'll
Well, just quickly on the question on the Academy of Directed Meat. So I think the mixed bag as far as the Academy of Nutrition Dietetics official position regarding marketing to children, they did put in comments to the Federal Trade Commission when they were looking at this issue in a constructive way. I mean, I think when there's something like that on the table, they're willing to, you know, kind of go with the flow and say that we need action on this, but they haven't really taken strong leadership. And then at the same time, you know, they have not only the partnerships I talked about, but a specific sort of child educational program with General Mills, I think, called Kids Eat Right. So, you know, they're engaging in this very corporate-friendly type of education, but not really being a leader when it comes to, you know, restricting and regulating marketing to children.
I can talk about artisanal producers. Artisanal products don't globalize. And so in order to globalize, artisanal product producers are being sucked into this global production network. I did my dissertation on this, et cetera. It's interesting. It's why wine has globalized so poorly. It's because wine's image is of an artisanal product. You can still get crappy wine more around the world than you used to, but it's wine still got that image. Can we work with the artisanal producers? I think it's critical to expose what the corporations are doing to ways of life, to quality of production, etc. Practically in the U.S., I refer over to the microbreweries, and what's happening with the microbreweries is they are the wedge to oppose alcohol tax increases across the country. They've increasingly been bought up by or partnered with the big producers. That's how they get shelf space, et cetera. And no, on that level, the best we can hope for in these campaigns is to sideline, and then even that hasn't been particularly helpful.
And I'll take on the slightly broader way the Citizens United question. I think really what's at the bottom of this is our decisions as a society, as a country, and globally about what are appropriate roles for the market and for government and for the public sector. And I think we've seen, particularly in the last, you know, since the early 1970s, a really tilt towards seeing markets as the solution and government as the problem. And I think many of the health problems that we're talking about today come about as a result of that. And I think we really need to reopen these questions. We've seen both a Supreme Court that's more corporate and business friendly than ever before in its history, a Congress that's more business friendly, and a series of White House administrations, while some important differences have been really seeing their task as enabling market success. And I think that notion is not compatible with environmental sustainability, democracy, or protecting public health. I think that's really the discussion we need to have as a nation. And that I think we as health educators and public health professionals have some very specific skills that we can contribute to having that discussion. And I think it really does require revisiting the notion that corporations, that commercial speech is protected is relatively recent. The notion that corporations have the right to political speech, that corporations are people, my friends, that's relatively recent. And if it changed as a result of very aggressive lobbying by the Chamber of Commerce and other business interests, it can change the other way. But that's something that we're going to have to do. And I think tying these questions of health and the promotion of hyperconsumption and the rise in chronic diseases to questions of what do we want for our democracy? What does it mean to be a democracy in the 21st century? What rights do we want as people? What's the responsibility of government to protect the well-being of its population versus the well-being of corporations? Those are the debates we need to be having. That's what a health educator's job should be. And maybe we'll end on that note of preaching. And thank you all so much for coming. And,